My name's Armin. I'm an alcoholic. And, yeah, I didn't know we were going to do all that housekeeping and medallions and everything. So we have a nice way of closing. So this is, first of all, I want to say congratulations to the celebrants. It's interesting. I have a unique relationship with each one of you, you know. Serge, I remember when you came on that first retreat. We hit it off right away. And, you know, Stevie, we've had a million great times, man, you know. And Tony, you're like a brother to me, you know. And Mark, you were introduced into my life through Eric, who is also like a brother to me. And you became my brother. You're his brother, you know. So I was happy to be here to watch each of you celebrate. So I'm honored. I'm humbled, although that for me, I don't really even know what that means. But to be here, but ego is definitely one of the things that I struggle with, and you'll be picking that up probably in the second hour of my talk tonight. But But anyway, my topic. So John did a great job, and Steve was right. When the five of us got together to be the retreat leaders, we started this little text, which was half planning and half kind of joshing with each other and having a good time. And John did a great job of pulling these readings out, and then went to the effort to send them off to us. And I printed mine out. So mine is Bill's talk entitled "This Matter of Fear," and it was in the Grapevine, January 1962. He wrote on this. So as soon as I saw this, the first thing that I thought about was that line in the Big Book that says, "Driven by a thousand forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking and self-pity." And then it goes on to say we step on the toes of others and they retaliate in kind. But the important thing was that first part. Driven by a thousand forms. Brothers, I have at least that many, man. I think I might be in the 5,000 range, you know, to be quite honest with you. And thank God that they don't all consume me at the same time. Because if they did, I'd be in Bridgewater State Hospital, you know. Or for you Floridians, South Florida State Hospital, right? Like, I'd be locked up. Because that's where fear can take me, to complete overwhelmed insanity. And sometimes when I look at people who are so unfortunate to be stricken and overwhelmed by mental health, I find myself, like these serious mental health issues where they're institutionalized, I find myself thinking sometimes, I'd love to follow that timeline backwards, right? Because they weren't always at that point, right? They were probably at some point in their lives at a fairly decent and healthy point, just like us. Maybe they had families. Maybe they had jobs. Maybe they had, you know, productive lives. And then their fears and their mental health issues became so great that they ended up institutionalized, you know? And that could happen to me. I could see it. I could see that happening. And how do I do that? Well, I'm going to talk about that tonight. So I want to talk about the sources of fear, and then I want to talk about the solutions of fear. You know, and I did a little research in some different books, which I may or may not get to. I don't know. You know, John and I were talking earlier about how, you know, just let it flow and let it go where it's going to go and share your experience. Because there's nothing. Look at this room. It's a room full of men that I look up to, honor, acknowledge their sobriety. I ain't teaching anybody shit here. You know what I mean? What I'm going to do is just share my experience, strength, and hope with you. You know? And so, but anyway, so these thousand forms of fear. So the first line in this article, Bill comes out and says, "As the AA book says, fear is an evil corroding thread, the fabric of our lives shot through with it. Fear is surely a bar to reason and to love. And of course, it invariably powers anger, vainglory, aggression. It underlies maudlin guilt and paralyzing depression." So I'm not as smart as the rest of you guys. So sometimes I have to look up words. I had to look up maudlin. And the definition of maudlin is self-pitying. This is from the Oxford Dictionary. Self-pitying or tearfully sentimental, often through drunkenness. That's what it says.
Perfect.
Like, you know, when you're sitting on a bar, so you're like, oh, man, I miss her. I want to go back to that place. Everything sucks, you know. And we've all been there, right? And that's that, you know. And so for me, I don't honestly ever really remember doing that when I was drinking, right? Because I drank in a way that was power mad. You know what I mean? And I did drugs in a way that was power mad. I wasn't a weepy barstool alcoholic, you know? I was a get drunk, let's fight and go to jail alcoholic. You know what I mean? But when I got sober and I started to do the work in these halls, then the maudlin came in, right? Then there was the emotional moments where I was overwhelmed. Then there was the times where I was weepy and crying and trying to work through it. And thank God I had gentlemen, right? And I wanted to say it that way, right? Gentlemen, but gentlemen that understood when to put the hammer down on me, but they also understood when to back up and say, it's going to be all right, bro. You're going to get through this, right? This too shall pass. Nothing is forever. Because the other thing I want to tell you is when I was out there drinking and drugging, if you had asked me, do I have fears? I would have told you no. And I would have actually believed that, right? Because I thought that I was fearless, you know? My friends and I would go to metal shows when I was a kid, and all my friends would line up behind me because they knew that I was going to plow through the crowd and be in front of the stage, right? Because I was fearless. I would hit people, push people, whatever I had to do, right? If the mouthiness started up in a bar room, I was always the first one to stand up and confront, you know? And I got hit a lot. But you want to know something too? That first punch that hits your jaw is actually a rush. For any of you that have been fighters out there drinking, you probably know what I'm talking about. When you're in a fight and you get that first punch on your jaw, it's like, yeah, jack you up. You know what I mean? And it was kind of funny. Like, you know, I came here and they started to tell me, you need to look at your fears. You know, and I was like, what fears? I don't have fears. What are you talking about? What am I fear? Oh my God, dudes. I am the most fear-based person you can imagine. I had a million masks. I was a master chameleon. I could fall into any group and assume the profile and the culture of the group so that I would fit in, so that you wouldn't be able to see how I was really feeling, which was, I'm not good enough. You're going to find out who I really am, and you're going to bounce me out of this group, right? And this was going on for a long, long time in my life, and it was a fear that I never even knew about. So Bill goes on to say in this article, the achievement of freedom from fear is a lifetime undertaking, one that can never be wholly completed. When under heavy attack, acute illness, or in other conditions of serious insecurity, we shall all react, well or badly, as the case may be. Only the vainglorious claim perfect freedom from fear, though their very grandiosity is really rooted in the fears they've temporarily forgotten. Right? That was me. I was the little kid whistling past the graveyard, right? I'm not afraid. Absolutely not, you know? And I was stricken with fear, you know? There are fears in my life today that I'm dealing with, you know? And I've been, you know, I'm 29 years sober, and I have been working very hard with my sponsor lately about realigning my will with God's will, right? He's been telling me, you know, for the last 4 years, brother, you've been running on your own will. Every time I'll present some crazy scenario or idea to him, he'll be like, why do you think that is? Because you've been so far apart from God's will for the past 4 years, and you need to realign yourself with that before you can make any decisions or change anything in your life. You need to find God again, right? That's not supposed to happen to guys with 29 years, you know? Like, and that's the problem too, is a lot of times we, in the rooms, you know, we concentrate so much on the newcomer, as we should, right? Because we want them to build the foundation. We want to guide them in. We want to show them this life. We want to show them this road. But a lot of times we forget about talking to the guy with time, right? Because sometimes the guy with time is scared shitless, cowering in a corner, right? Right here. I'll stand right at the front of that line, you know. And so he goes on to say, the foundation stone of freedom from fear is that of faith, right? So it's interesting that that's our thing. That's our theme this week, right? From fear to faith. Stevie's going to close it up with faith on Sunday. In the middle, you're going to get bam, you know, you're going to get British Steel, right? You're going to get the Power album, right? And, I mean, these guys that are presenting this weekend, I'm more excited to listen to them than to do this, right? A faith that, despite all worldly appearances to the contrary, causes me to believe that I live in a universe that makes sense. So that was the other thing. So with my fear comes delusion. There's a delusion component to my fear, because when I start getting fearful, now my disease has me right where it wants me, right? Because it's like, oh, you're scared? Oh, good. Now, I've been sober a long time, so my disease is not brazen enough to say, Armin, let's ride down to Cracktown. Or Armin, let's go get a bottle of tequila, right? So what it's going to do is it's going to employ my character defects to start chipping away at me, right? And then I reach that point where my disease says, look at you, sitting up in them meetings talking all that wonderful crap, but I know who you really are, right? And now let's go, right? Now when I'm at that point where I'm shot through with the fear, now I'm susceptible to the idea of maybe I can take a drink, you know, because I want relief. We all want relief, right? Everyone and every one of us in here. And I love this line from Carl Jung. This is in the article. Any person who has reached 40 years of age, is there anyone here who's reached 40 years of age? Everyone who's reached 40 years of age, raise your hand. I want to see who the kids are in the room. All right, good. Okay. Any person who's reached 40 years of age and who still has no means of comprehending who he is, where he's next going, cannot avoid becoming a neurotic to some degree or the other. This is true whether his youthful drives for sex, material security, and a place in society have been satisfied or not satisfied. When the benign doctor used the term becoming neurotic, he might just as well have said becoming fear-ridden, right? And that's it, right? A long time ago, I heard in AA, you know, the two things we fear are not getting what we want and losing what we have, right? And sometimes, because I live in that place of vainglory, and because my sponsor has to work with me to realign my will with God, sometimes I think that what I want is what I deserve, right? I worked hard for that. I need that thing, whatever that thing is. And sometimes going after the thing that I want means I'm going to lose the things that I have, right? Some of you guys might know what I'm talking about, you know? And this was another line I left from the article. 1962, okay? But still true today. We of AA now find ourselves living in a world characterized by destructive fears as never before in history, but in it we nevertheless see great areas of faith and tremendous aspiration toward justice and brotherhood. 1962. The Beatles hadn't even come to America yet. 1962. I wasn't alive in 1962. Some of you probably were, but I do know that it was a much simpler, more peaceful time in our country, right? And yet, they were talking about the world of fear. Now fast forward to 2023 and think about the world we live in. Think about all the fear that's out there, right? Everybody is fear-mongering. Politicians, churches, governments, business, everybody's fear-mongering everybody else. And yet here we all sit in AA with our differing of opinions and our cups of coffee and our cigars, and we go, shit's going pretty good, isn't it? Like, this is awesome, right? Right? Like, because we have the gift that really the world doesn't have, right? So we're not as prone to get sucked into that fear machine. Sometimes we do. I do. you know. But then I look back and I remember, I was already on the Titanic, man. You know what I mean? I already went down, got a life raft, got saved. So really, after that, everything's gravy. You know, I remember when I was doing my third step with my sponsor, Mark O'Brien. Some of you know him, and at that time, so it was probably like, I got sober November 3rd, 93. It was probably like 95 time frame, right? I was doing my third step. I was a slow mover on the steps. And I remember fighting off this idea in step three of turning my will over to anything, right? I'm not turning my will over to anything. Like, that was directly against the code of the street that I learned, right? The code of the street that I learned was scrape your friggin' knuckles on the pavement before you give up an inch of earth, right? Like, you never, ever give up or voluntarily hand over anything, right? And so I was at the 101 club, and I was at one of the 545 meetings, probably Straight Talk Wednesday night. And there was a guy that used to go to the meetings back then. His name was Alabama Bill, and he used to sit. You know what I loved about the 101 club? For any of you guys who were 101 club guys back in the day, everybody sat in the same seats all the time. You guys remember that stand? I don't even remember that. Paul, you probably remember that. Everybody sat in the same seats all the time. And it was great because it was consistent. It was dependable. I could walk in that side door of the 101 club and look to my left, four tables down, against the glass barrier with the back exit door, and there was Alabama Bill, you know, every time I walked in. So I walked in. And it was before the meeting, and I'm sitting with Bill, and he's like, "How you doing, kid?" And I said, "I'm working on my third step, man, and it's not happening for me. Like, I'm not getting this." And he's like, "Well, what's the problem?" And I said, "I'm not turning my will over to anything, bro. That's not happening. Like, I'm not that guy. Like, maybe you guys are, but I'm not, you know." And he was like, "Well, I think you're forgetting one important word in the step." And I said, what word is that? And he said, care. The step says, turn your will and your life over to the care of God as we understood. And he was right. I wasn't seeing that word. And he said, well, let's just say for a minute, like tomorrow morning you go out to your mailbox and you pull a letter out and it's from an attorney. And he says, you had a rich uncle somewhere. And he's got a 100-acre plantation and you've inherited this plantation. He said, do you know anything about cultivating livestock or crops or how to run a farm? He said, do you know anything about that? And I said, no, I don't know anything about that. You know, I'm from Coral Springs. Like, you know what I mean? And he said, well, then it would make sense that you would hire a caretaker that understood how to run that farm and maximize and leverage the livestock, the crops, et cetera, from that farm. And he said, so it's the same thing in AA. You came in AA, you got sober, we handed you a 100-acre life. You have no idea how to manage it. So why don't you hire a caretaker that knows how to manage it? So don't look at God as your drill sergeant. Don't look at God as your taskmaster. Look at God as your partner who's working for you to maximize and leverage this life that you've now been given. Oh, my God. You know, you guys have all, probably, like me, have all had those moments where I've sat in AA and I went, these people are brilliant. Like, who are these people? Like, you know, like, did they all go to MIT or something? Like, these people are all brilliant. And they didn't go to MIT. They were like high school dropouts and postmen and, you know, construction workers. But they had this amazing way of framing this program and handing it to me, you know. And that happened that night. And it freed me. And that was one of those fear moments for me. So there's a couple things I want to read to you, and then we're going to tie it up. I'm still going to finish this by 8:15. You watch. So many years ago, I read this book called The Four Agreements, and some of you have probably read it. And so for me, it was an absolute game-changer book. And so for any of you that haven't read it, I will share my perception of how I understand the book. It doesn't mean that those of you who have read it would understand it the same way, but that's how I understood the book. So as a young man, as a boy, really, I was handed agreements by people in my life, my parents, my teachers, my coaches, right, that said, this is how you look at things, right? When this situation arises, this is what you think, right? And I was handed these agreements at 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years old, when a child is like a sponge and just absorbing everything, right? And I stored those agreements, and then I went out into life with all these agreements. And some of them were very good agreements, right? And some of them were not so good, you know? And those agreements became the basis for my fear, right? Because when something was going on in life that didn't match my agreement, I got afraid. I got scared, right? Oh, wait a minute. This is not going how I think it's supposed to go. And then one of two things would happen. I would either have to change it, so then the power Matt Armin comes out and I'm going to muscle this baby and I'm going to move mountains to where I want things to happen. And I was being told by other people, yes, go move mountains, you know? And so those agreements were being formed. Or I would go the other way and I would hide, right? Oh, things aren't going the way I want. I would hide. And you know where I hid? In a bottle, right? That was my favorite hiding place. Because once I started pouring the booze in, I started taking the drugs, I forgot about all that stuff anyway. I didn't care. Didn't matter to me. Took it away. It was relief, you know? And so in the book, The Four Agreements, Ruiz talks about the goal is to take these agreements that were given to us at very young ages and unwind them and create new agreements that now fit our morality and our ethics and our belief on life. So earlier today, one of the things I've learned to do over the past 5 or 6 years, I've gotten into this thing. Some of you might be familiar with it. It's called earthing or grounding. So the Native Americans believe that, like, when our feet are on the earth, we are in touch with the power source, right? The earth from which we come and the earth from which we return. So I went out and I took my shoes off and I walked around the lake, but not on the path, on the grass, which is so nice to do, right? Because I live in Boston, so this time of year you can't really earth, right? You know, not a good place to earth in February, but Florida is, right? And I walked and I just got real peaceful, and I watched the fountain and I said a prayer, and I said, you know, God, just. Wherever you want this to go tonight, take it, you know. And I was peaceful. And that's one of the ways that I overcome my fears now. When I'm fearful, I earth. When COVID hit, one of the great, like, silver linings of COVID was everything was shut down. And I was stuck in the house with my wife and, at the time, my 18-year-old daughter. So there were large opportunities for insanity, like, in my mind going on at that time, right? And so every Saturday morning, I would go out and I would find a trail somewhere and I'd walk the trail. And what I love to do is get deep into the woods. And for any of you guys that are, y'all don't really have it down here in Florida, but you know how the woods smell up north? They have, like, this smell, like, that's just incredible. And I would find my way into, like, a deep part of one of these trails, and I would just, like, sit on a rock and smell and just, like, get calm and just, like, meditate. And it became this ritual that I would do every Saturday morning, you know. And sometimes I would take my hiking boots off and I'd get that mossy, wet, you know, ground, and just felt great. And it would take away all my fears. And so there's a couple of things that I want to just read to you, and then I'm going to close it. Okay. 8:20. We'll go 8:20. So this is a book that I got turned on to by a friend of mine about 25 years ago. It's called Touchstones for Men, and it's one of my go-to daily meditations. And so January 9th is a great reading. Fear is an emotion indispensable for survival. So that's the other thing I really didn't talk about tonight. Sometimes fear is a good thing, right? Sometimes fear is logical. Sometimes fear keeps us from, you know, stepping in the path of real damage, right? And that quote is by Hannah Arendt, and I have no idea who that person is. But the reading is, we men face fear many times in our lives. Sometimes it's an inner voice warning us of danger. Some fears remain from the paranoia caused by our former abuses and excesses. In recovery, we don't understand them. Any normal feeling can seem abnormal and frightening to a man who is feeling it for the first few times. We may think it isn't mainly to be afraid. It isn't manly to be afraid, so we become afraid of our fear. So that was a big thing for me, right? Because my dad was a wonderful man, and he did the best he could with me, and I love him. And me and my father had a great relationship, and he was on a lot of my fourth and fifth steps. And before he died, I had the opportunity to just, I'd already made amends to him several times, so there was nothing left. At the end of his life, it was just, I love you, Dad, and expressing our love for each other, right? But one of the things he taught me that was not a good agreement was, what happens in this house stays in this house. Right? We don't share our fears. No one out there could know we're afraid of things, or we have struggles, or we're, you know, there's infighting, right? And that wasn't a good agreement for me. Yeah, it might have been a good agreement for my siblings, but it wasn't for me. So, at these times, we need to turn to a higher power for guidance. So there it is again, right? Faith, God, that's the answer. And I'm not here to push any kind of God on anybody. I could care less what your God is, but I hope you have one, right? Because you're going to need one, right? He comes in real handy at certain times, you know? This is actually how I get my God. We have friends we can talk to. When we simply say, I am afraid, to a trusted friend, the fear may vanish, right? Dave talked years ago, and I shared a lot up north, to the point that they now think it's mine, and that's good. But so Dave talked about the hand on the shoulder. And he said, like, when one of us is troubled, you may tell me you're troubled, then I may have no answer for you, right? But I just put my hand on your shoulder. And I said, you're good, you know, it's going to be all right. Don't drink. You know, and that takes your fear away for a moment, right? It helps you get a little clarity to work through it. So we have friends we can talk to. When we simply say, I'm afraid to trust a friend, the fear may vanish. Sometimes it's not that easy. We have to talk in detail about our fear. And there are some men in this room that I've done that with too. Like really got down to the nitty gritty, you know. In the end, when we submit our lives to the care of our higher power, we know that whatever happens, nothing can separate us from the love of God. In my fear, help me remember the comfort of my closeness to my higher power and my loved ones. I can reach out and I'm never alone. And so that is the final solution for me, is to not take my fears and stuff them down inside of me and not talk to you about them, because that's what I'm prone to do, right? I don't want Tony to know that there's stuff going on in my life that I'm afraid of. And yet every time I end up with Tony, we end up in these conversations where, and it ain't a Superman thing under there. It's like a little quivering child, right? And we talk, and we've done that for each other. And I'm not just pointing out Tony. Stevie, John, Dave, Eric, there's probably half this room I've had those kind of conversations with, you know. And so to honor my friend Spike, in closing, 8:19, I'm going to make it. This is a book that a friend of mine turned me on to about a year ago. It's called One Foot in Front of the Other, and it's by a recovery specialist named Tyan Date. Fantastic book. Like, if any of you guys want to know more about it, see me after the meeting. I'll tell you about it. But what Tyan does is, before each month, she does this daily meditation, but before each month, she does like one big reading from somewhere, and she shares it that kind of sets the tone for the month, and then you go into the day. So for March, one of the books that had a great impact on me, I read it at 15 years old, it was The Prophet by Khalil Gibran, and I still read it regularly. But I don't read it all the way through, I'll open it to like one section and just read that section. And so there was a section where they're talking about pain. And so the way the book is set up is, this prophet is leaving this town, and the town is having a celebration and a farewell for him in the town center. And so each of the people ask him a question and ask him to espouse upon the question. And so each chapter is like on pain, on children, on marriage, on work, whatever it is. So the one on pain, a woman spoke saying, tell us of pain. And he said, the pain is the breaking of the shell that encloses your understanding. Even as the stone of the fruit must break, that its heart may stand in the sun, so must you know pain, right? And for the context of this conversation, just replace the word pain with fear, because it's the same concept, right? And could you keep your heart in wonder at the daily miracles of your life, your pain would not seem less wondrous than your joy. So I have to have my fears so that I can work through them. I can't hide from them. I can't just push them aside. I have to have them, and I have to work through them, and then I have to turn to God for the guidance on where I'm going to go from there, right? And you would, as you would accept the seasons of your heart, even as you've always accepted the seasons to pass over your fields, and you would watch with serenity through the winters of your grief, much of your pain is self-chosen. It is the bitter potion by which the physician within you heals your sick self. Therefore, trust the physician and drink his remedy in silence and tranquility. For his hand, though heavy and hard, is guided by the tender hand of the unseen. And the cup he brings, though it burns your lips, has been fashioned to the clay which the potter has moistened with his own sacred tears. So basically what he's saying there is every piece of pain, every piece of fear, everything that we go through, we need to hold that and value it just like we would the good times, because there's a teacher there too, right? I heard a saying one time, and I'm embarrassed to say that it actually came off a meme on Facebook, but it was actually like really powerful for me. And it said, when I stop asking why is this happening to me, and I start asking what is this teaching me, my whole perspective changes. So I hope that's some catalyst for the small groups tonight, and I'm looking forward to the rest of this thing, and thank you.